portion of the balance, which will be on this side here. Is heavily timbered with a level surface, quite wet and swampy in many places. The soil, dark and sandy loam, intermingled with some pretty heavy clay. The southern half of this part of the township, this eastern part, is composed of white oak or timbered openings and a little timbered land, and about one-fourth of the whole is open marsh. Its surface is varied, being quite hilly in the west, and this is the entire township. More level in the east, and soil quite diversified. The soil of the township is somewhat mixed with loose stone of many kinds. Some places, the work of some coral insect, and others are clearly petrifications. Many boulders, some pea to walnut size stones, seemingly smit together and make pudding stone. This is over in this area here. Some of you old timers may run onto a pudding stone or two. Among natural curiosities and peculiar features of an early day indicate some race, intelligent people once lived here and died here before the Potawatomi Indians located here. The Indians of the era from 1750 to 1850 have no tradition related to these early comers or these relics. On the east and the west shore of Gilead Lake and other places in the township are found remains of what could be aged fortifications. I talked with Kenneth about this, and he remembers, this is Kenneth Cranson, about the one on this side of the lake to which we refer. These are fortifications were circular in form, elevated at present, and that was in 1870, about 2 feet above the general ground level. The one on the east shore, lying south of the arm of the Gilead Lake, running to the east, evidently on the present farm owned by W.C. Worley. The shore is a steep bluff 15 feet above the lake and extends 30 rods in each direction, then gradually descends to a lower level. Now, on this plateau, with its two extremities touching the cliff in a semicircular arc, 18 to 20 rods in diameter, so true that it had to be laid out before the trees now growing were sprouted. Along this line is an elevation 6 to 8 feet wide and 18 inches high. The trees are now about 150 to 200 years old. Burial mounds are to be found in other parts of the township. This same story runs true in the other townships, in Batavia Township, on the back of the farm of Guy Bailey, and also on the old Bennett farm at the north end of Madison Lake. Burial mounds are to be found in other parts of the township, relics of Indian race and their pottery. Another natural curiosity is the Gilead Sugarwoods, a piece of maple wood standing in section 17, earlier extended to Section 7, 8, and 18. It was in 1830, a fine growth of maple woods in the form of a circle, 3/4 of a mile across. Indians, in their crude way, tapped the trees in the early spring, and the white settlers continued to do so. Now, the water courses across the township are the outlets. The main one is the outlet from Hog Lake and Pleasant Lake. It's called the Prairie River. It runs in a northerly direction. It is also the outlet of Levine, Pleasant, and Crooked Lakes of Kinderhook. The drains from Pleasant Lake and Hog Lake flow northerly and unite with the drain from Kinderhook in Section 3 of the township. The flow is quite rapid at this point, and with sufficient fall for a mill site. The mill was built there in 1835 and was used through 1879. When the pond, named Island Pond, because in the northern part is an island. Here is this mill pond that has disappeared all these years. This pond was thought to be an obstacle to proper drainage of the swamps. It was condemned and removed at about that time. and drainage districts developed. Now, the poem of the East Gilead Canal by Samuel Arnold was written as a result of this, which is, and as I quote here, a good share of this is from the 1879 history, which lays here on the desk and is owned by the Society. Gilead Lake, in section 6 and 7, is 200 acres in size, irregular in shape. The water is clear and cold, and has an average depth of 40 feet. There's no visible inlet or outlet. The old history indicates that about a mile and a quarter southeasterly of the lake, which would lie over in this direction here, a large and never-failing spring flowed, and they felt that this was the outlet of the lake. I've inquired of many of the old-timers, and nobody seems to know about that spring. At this time, the banks of the lake rise in bluffs 10 to 15 feet, and the shores are bold, composed of sand and gravel. The township received its name from Bishop Philander Chase. He moved here from Mount Gilead, Ohio. The first settler in the southern tier of the township was John Croy in 1831. He came at 25 years of age with his wife, Margaret, and two or three children from Monroe. I presume that was the city in Monroe County. To Brunson, then to White Pigeon, Pretty Prairie, thence to Gilead in the spring of 1831. He built a pole shanty near the north line of the southeast quarter of Section 7. This would be that letter 6 until the northeast corner of Section 7. So this would be that up here by the lake. About 100 rods west and a little south of the present Methodist Church. This was written in 1879, which has now disappeared. It was a crude and rough, about 12 feet square, the pole shanty we refer to, and served as a home until a log house was built on the north side of the road, 50 rods east and north of the shanty. A baby girl, Mary Croy, was born in the shanty. This is the first child born in the township. Mary grew up and married Andrew Fuller and lived here until 1879. John Croy later moved to Iowa. The next settler to figure largely in the early history of the township was Bishop Philander Chase, previously interested in a denominational school. He came here to establish an Episcopalian college, also a community where, and you can follow through that the writer had this because of the feeling, maybe, priority, authority, and superiority, he could wield influence. He arrived in the early spring of 1831, guided here by Wales Adams and Thomas Holmes, whom he had met over here in, on this map here, in Brunson Township, where the Holmeses and Mr. Wales had built a mill, and they had put in a water course there, which was, by the way, that one was taken out because it bothered them with their drainage problems there. So that's the first that the name of Holmes came into the area. Mr. Wales operated that mill for some time. They found Mr. Croy on his farm, and the bishop selected about 800 to 1,000 acres of land, which he went to White Pigeon. That was the place of making the entry. From the government. Lumber was hauled from Wales Adams Sawmill in Brunson Township. The bishop erected a shanty in the form of a letter A in which he lived, and he used his carriage, which was quite an outfit, I guess, to sleep in. On the 5th of May, he engaged three fellows from White Pigeon by the name of Miller, Humphrey, and Thurber, to build him a house. This was the first frame house in Gilead, located on the southwest quarter of Section 9, about where Lynn Calhoun lived. 7, 8, and 9 would be right down in here. I don't know, does Lynn still own the farm in Melbourne?
No.
And they thought, okay, this is the changes that go on, and I have to be updated here because, and think of material other than the lumber was for the house came from White Pigeon, which is quite a trading center, hauled by a Mr. Raymond, and he also brought an old covered wagon under which the party slept and the supplies were stored. Water for the workmen was brought from Gilead Lake in a 6-quart tin pail. The bishop's family, his wife and 4 children, Dudley, Henry, Mary, and Junior, ages 20 to 11. Also, a house was built at this time near the middle of Section 8 for a tenant named James Glass, and they spoke of it as the Glass House. He assisted in the farming operation. The next autumn, the bishop built another larger dwelling and moved into it, and also harvested the first crop of wheat in the county, it speaks of it here, 40 acres. In 1833, Bishop built a two-story school building, 20 by 30. In this building, a small school was taught by Samuel Chase, the bishop's nephew. The bishop's niece, Mrs. Russell, and her daughter were part of his family. The nephew and the grandniece were married on a Sunday morning, and it was the first wedding in the township after, and they didn't give her name, and I assume it was Miss Russell, with a large attendance, many of the people coming from a great distance. So you remember what a shindig, well, probably not, being Episcopalian, but they came from quite a distance, several from English Prairie, Indiana. For the service, the bishop was clad in all his dignity of his official robes, and it lasted a long time. And this was also witnessed by Samuel Booth, who was still living in 1879. And by the way, this last summer, the Episcopal Church of Coldwater held a service here in the area on the farm. Mrs. Glenn Hughes. And she said that there were about 150, and they were pretty well here from the western part of the state, the diocese of the Episcopal Church, in celebration of the advent of Bishop Chase to this area. Now, soon after this, Bishop Chase went on a mission to England for funds for his school and his academy. While he was away, the nice house burned, and they got a lot of items out of it, but the story of his home burning, going to England, helped him with his fundraising. So this is one way to raise funds. Maybe we should burn a building down here for our historical society. The bishop brought from Ohio, it speaks of here, is 100 head of cattle. That seems quite strong to me. There's another story I have here about his son going to Chicago and acquiring some, and it relates somewhat of the way they carried on their farming operations at that time. I'll quote from it a little later. Also, some grass seed, which the bishop had brought from Ohio, he broadcast from the back of a horse. In the openings, the grass was different, resembling the bluegrass of Kentucky. And it grew easily, and it was hardy, and it spread throughout the area and became known as the bishop's grass. In 1836, because of misunderstanding and so forth, Bishop Chase sold his interest in Gilead Township and moved to Robin's Nest, Peoria, Illinois, where he built his college, was appointed the bishop of that diocese. So this is where he was main head. The seminary building stood in 1879 on the John Keesler farm on Section 9. Is the Keesler still on this? Do we recall? Anyone recall anything? I don't have my map right here. No, I don't see the name of Keesler in that section. The bishop built the first sawmill in Prairie River near the east line of Section 4 in 1834, and the dam was taken out, as we had previously stated. Following shortly after Bishop Chase in 1831, come Abishai, I'm getting that word pronounced wrong, my wife told me that too, Sanders.
Abishai.
Okay, thank you. My English isn't this good, I guess. And his wife Rachel and eight children came from Big Island, Marion County, Ohio. And they came in two wagons. One was pulled by two yoke of oxen. The second was by one yoke of oxen and one horse. They came by Sandusky and Toledo, followed the Territorial Road and the Chicago Turnpike to the Brunson Prairie. Then they turned southward and followed this trail. It's the same as the way the bishop came across there. Because otherwise they just had to have gone down through the woods and found the location that they were looking for. They called this then following the Indian Trail leading to Jackson Prairie, Indiana. Then they came to Gilead and took up 240 acres of land in Section 8 and 9. Section 8 and 18, excuse me. Entered by Mr. Sanders the previous fall. He constructed a pen of rails covered by a shake roof for their first home. He prepared ground, planted potatoes and turnips, and he brought a bowl plow to prepare ground for planting after clearing. Crops were put in on July the 4th, which is a little late. A log cabin was built later, and Mr. Sanders was elected the first supervisor, we'll relate a little later, for a total of 6 years. I believe that Mr. Sanders was the forefather of Ezra Sanders. They didn't feel that he was, so this is something that might be surveyed. A Mr. Downer, a bachelor from one of New England states, came to Gilead at this period and entered three lots on the north shore of Gilead Lake. He built the first log house in the township, Section 6, about 20 rods south of what is widely known as Marsh's Corners. The house stood until 1842, furnished temporary housing to pioneers. And this was the home first of Booth, the Clarks, and the Eastmans. In the spring of 18, I feel just warmer and everything. Everybody feel this warm too? I think we should open the door up or something. Can we do that, Hannah, please? I usually warm up when I work, but I don't know. It's just, beg pardon?
Heat's all up.
Well, that's as far as it is. You're cooler down. Okay.
We're cool here.
In the spring of 1832, Benjamin Booth left Manlius, Onondaga County, New York, and came west to Michigan at Niles Corners in Oakland County. He left his family there and with his brother-in-law, William Purdy, came west to Brunson, and he heard of Bishop Chase in Gilead, so they visited him. Mr. Booth said he desired to go no further, for this country was good enough for him. He entered land in July and returned to Oakland and brought his family here. And it was August of the year. A new house was built on the south shore of Gilead Lake while the family lived in the Downer home. 2 years later, Mr. Booth built the second frame house in the township, the large living room used as the meeting place for elections and religious meetings. Samuel, a son, resided in Gilead after others had moved and passed away. And the last of the family now has been Harry Booth, and I understand on Section 8 they have this 160 acres, and it passed on down through the family.
It's right here across the road.
Just right here. Okay, very good. And so this is ties right in with someone who is still here. Now, William Purdy, the brother-in-law, and a direct descendant of Mr. Purdy is Mrs. Burnett Zeal. And her father was Edward Purdy. He was born in 1834. It was the brother-in-law. So here's a tie-in with the Zila family then, as we know them there, who have lived south of Coldwater. And the daughter is Ruth Smith, of course, with whom most of you are acquainted. so they came in the year of 1835, during the year after, had a log house built, 20 acres broken up, and sold it to Wheat. He was the first blacksmith in the township, and he took a portion of his pay for the work that he did for the settlers for breaking. And then these fellows would go out and clear his farm. And his farm is the east half, the southwest quarter, section 9. And on surveying the farm, they found out that his house and the barn and his shop were in the highway. Now, Job Williams moved to Gilead in 1836 with his wife and six children. He had earlier bought 300 acres on the north shore of Gilead Lake. The family moved into the log house, except Elisha R., and he and his wife and three children moved into the Kelly house, which he had previously purchased. Job's house was 12 rods from the Gilead Lake shore, and Job had bought this 300 acres from an attorney in New York State, and this attorney had allowed Bishop Chase to farm that and take the proceeds. Attorney didn't get anything. This is unusual. Unusual attorney, I'd say. And use it for his school project here in, well, Mr. Williams, Job Williams, he hadn't agreed to that, so the bishop was not able to harvest his wheat. So there's a little ill feeling there. And I've heard of other fellows doing that, not getting the crop harvested, which is another story. But Williams, not having to bargain, did not let the bishop harvest the wheat. Now, when Bishop Chase sold out in 1836, Job Williams wanted to buy a cow. And the bishop said, "No way, you don't buy any cow of me. I didn't get my wheat off the farm." So Bishop got William Purdy to buy the cow, and then when the bishop found out, why then he saw he had been thwarted once again. In the spring of 1837, Job Williams brought to the township the first cast iron plow, and he secured it at Clinton, Michigan. It was the first improved plow in the township, and it was used from dawn till dark all that season, and on moonlight nights, they plowed all night long. Job lived until March 24th, 1857. The older son, Elisha B., and the youngest son, Edwin M., lived here in 1879, engaged in farming and manufacturing a planter and a grass seeder. So, invented by Edward and patented in June 13, 1876. A son, Warren C., died February 14, 1843. And he was the first burial in the cemetery there at the north side of the lake, which Mr. Williams donated to the township. Now the story goes on about the Williams, which was near the Union Church, and I understand that this was located on Bernice Lazenby's farm and has been torn down. Probably some of you have attended the church there, have you? And
moved away.
Beg your pardon?
It was moved away.
Oh, it was moved away. I guess I didn't.
Okay.
I can show it to you where it is.
Well, I was right there. They're laying an irrigation line right down across there yesterday. I talked by telephone with D. Warren Williams, son of Del E. Williams, and learned that Joe was his great-grandfather, that the D. E. Williams acquired the present farm owned by Forrest Williams about 1879, which is the south half of the north half of Section 8, which is right here right in the middle.
This building sits right up.
Well, this is right here,
don't
we? Right. On the Dell Williams farm. Good enough. I first made Warren's acquaintance, as I related first, when I started high school. And Warren operated the farm, the family farm, after graduation until he adventured very successfully into the grain handling and milling business. I related this story told by Henry Wilbur, who was a farmer, car salesman, auctioneer. I worked with Henry at the Batavia Co-ops in the early 30s, and I became acquainted with a lot of people here from Gilead, L.S. Davis, Hal Heights, and so on down the line, Phil Hughes. And, well, at that time, Henry was selling Ford cars in the early 20s, and he called on Warren Williams while he was plowing here in the field to sell a car. Warren was in the field with three horses on the traditional sulky pile, and Henry made known that he had a car to sell. Warren says, I have to get this plowing done. Well, Henry says, keep right on with your plowing. I'll keep up with you and make you a deal. So across the field, the auto dealer went, along with the plowman. A Ford car was delivered to Billy Township. Horace B. Williams and Nathaniel Joe settled in Gilead in 1838. He served as township supervisor and justice of peace. He's said to have introduced the first threshing machine in Gilead. Better see if I'm going here yet. Yep. Never stop. The Green family moved from Akron, Ohio, and arrived in Gilead June 9, 1841. They moved in to the half-finished house of D.C. Mather. Uncle Dave bought 200 acres of land on the state line at $3.80 an acre. He bought it of Dave Waterman with 5 acres cleared. Frame house was built and occupied in July. After 26 years, he moved to Coatter, and he served as sheriff, U.S. assessor, deputy provost marshal, and judge of probate as of 1879, and now he was in his third term. A son, Elijah C.S. Green, farmer on the east half of Northwest Quarter, later owned by Homer Green, the auctioneer, who I've heard him cry sales, and Harry Green, brother of Homer, lived on the west half of Southwest Quarter, and the farm there was lately owned by his son, Stanley Green. Stanley, I guess, is just sold. Very good. So a brother of David N. Green, his name was Alexander R. Green, lived on the west half of the Southwest Quarter, where the Don Hootengarner farm is located, down the road here from the little school, right down the road. Alec was the father of Leon R. Green, and later Leon lived on the farm from 1900 to 1915. Then Leon moved to Coatter and operated an auto agency and served as sheriff through the late 20s and the early 30s. Because remember, he was reelected in 32. His widow Grace, some 96 years of age, resides at 79 West Pearl Street, Coatter, with her daughter. I talked with her on the phone. Her voice is just as clear as it was 20 years ago. I was amazed. Still going. Benjamin S. Wilkins from Marion County, Ohio, was the first settler except the Fullers east of the Prairie River. That's over on the east side. And the Wilkins family is still there. I think one of the Wilkinses married Mrs. Schaefer's daughter there. It's on Mrs. Schaefer's farm, are they? That's just over in Kinderhook, where the tornado blew the house down. He came first in the summer of 1831 and located land on the southeast quarter, section 31, and returned to Ohio and got married and returned in 1836. He and his wife hired out to Mr. Sanders again for a year. Before starting to work, he built a log house. Then he and his wife worked with Mr. Sanders for 1 year, and then they moved back to their home. He and his son John cleared 160 acres and bought more ground. He died in August of 1872. His wife's name was Melinda. Samuel Arnold came to Kinderhook from New York in 1836. His wife and three children remained in New York and lived with the wife's uncle. Samuel lived with the wife's uncle at Kinderhook, then known as Waterhouse Corners. That winter, he taught the first school in Kinderhook, and that winter, he entered the west half of Southeast Quarter in Section 11 in Gilead, known as Arnold's Corners, right here in East Gilead. In the fall of 1837, he returned to New York, brought his family to Gilead, and while living in the Brady House at Hog Lake, built a shanty on his farm, and then moved into it and lived there 4 years. Emerson Marsh of Marsh's Corners on the north line of the township was the first merchant in Gilead. He came from a town of New York. Excuse me. I met a fellow from Oneida there, and he corrected me and said, "Oh, I'm from Oneida." He did work in the Oneida Silver, or the cutlery works there in New York, this Florida, this winter. And so he came in the spring of 1838 and brought his peddler's wagon. You all remember the peddler's wagon, how they used to go around the country way back when we were kids, eh? Not lately. Lemuel L. Graham came from Sturgis in 1844. He lived there for 11 years and bought a large tract of land formerly owned by Bishop Chase. Mr. Graham died in the next year. His son, also Lemuel L., lived on the homestead of the southwest quarter of Section 17, and as of the 1973 plat book, which is there, the farm is still in the Graham family. Son of Lemuel Graham, the Lemuel L. Graham, his name was Professor Daniel Graham, who was once president of Hillsdale College, and A.J. Graham of New York City, celebrated shorthand reporter, an author of several books, an inventor of phonographic recording. And then we come to one of the outstanding citizens, and probably the outstanding, is Cyrus G. Luce. He moved to Gilead in 1849. He became most distinguished citizen of the township. Walter Luce, his father, left the family home in Connecticut, where the family had lived for about 200 years. They had been home since 1639. Walter left Connecticut in 1815 and moved to Ohio. And at Winster, Ashtabula County in 1820, he married Mary Graves. Cyrus was born July 2nd, 1824. In 1836, the family, composed of six sons, moved to Mill Grove, Steuben County, Indiana, near Orland. And while living there, two daughters were born. Walter died April the 20th, 1872, 78 years of age. His wife lived until 1879, until the age of 76. Cyrus was educated in the ordinary school plus. At the age of 15, he started in and attended Northeastern Collegiate Institute at Ontario, Indiana, for three winter terms. The balance of the time he spent working on the farm. His father placed him in charge of the carding and fulling mill. He married Julia A. Dickinson, daughter of Obed and Experience Dickinson, and settled on the farm. The family grew to five children, four living in 1879. Emory G. lived on the Gilead farm during our memory. The home farm was added to until it totaled 400 acres. Cyrus G. engaged in mercantile and produce business in Orland for 7 years in company with other partners. In public life, Cyrus G. first ran for Indiana State Legislature in 1848. In Gilead, he served as a supervisor for 9 years. In 1854, he was elected to the state legislature. And then in 1858, he was elected treasurer of Branch County, re-elected. Building the police department, the fire department is now located. We remember it before it was torn down. I think Harold Palmer lived there at one time, if I recall right. Returning to Gilead just before the meeting. The first master was Cyrus G. Luce. Overseer was Darwin A. Thompson. Lecturer was George J. Langs. The name Lycurgus Langs rings in my memory. I've heard it said that this was the basis on which he became state prominent at the Governor and all. He served, in August of 1886, Mr. Luce was nominated by the Republican Party in convention at Grand Rapids for acclamation. On November the 2nd, he was elected over George L. Yackel for the governorship of the state of Michigan. And I believe that George Yackel was an attorney out of the city of Coldwater.
Yeah.
This is correct. Because I heard one or two other people note that too. Luce County in the Upper Peninsula was named in the governor's honor. The Luce School at the corner of Snow Prairie and Southern Road was built in 1908 at the time of his death, also in his honor. Now, Gabriel Hoopengarner owned 140 acres on Section 18 in Gilead Township. Mr. Hoopengarner was born in Winfield. There comes another name, Tuscarawas, I guess. County, Ohio. On August the 12th, 1826, he worked on the farm, then he entered the mercantile business, and later he bought a tannery, operated that for 12 years. He sold out and traveled west in 1864 with his family of 7 boys and 7 girls and wife and himself. He moved to Gilead Township and settled on this farm. He increased that to 240 acres, and he died on December 30th, 1920. And this is about 86. About 94 years old then, wasn't he? These people from Gilead here, they're good place to live, isn't it?
Right.
The farm is in the name of Mr. and Mrs. George Hoopengarner as of 1973, and I guess it still is. Gabriel was a lifelong Democrat, voting first for President Pierce in 1848. He was buried in a cemetery donated by him to the township. Reverend C. A. Cutler officiated at the funeral. We all remember him in our family, all around Brunson. He also served here in Mr. Cutler did at the church in Kinderhook, too. Mrs. Paul Hathaway, daughter of Sarah Hoopengarner Larkin, and I spelled that wrong, too, by the way, was born on the Larkin farm on the east side of Gilead Lake. Mrs. Hathaway makes her home on the family farm of 150 acres in section southeast quarter, section 5, which was purchased by the Hathaway family in 1865 from Horace D. Williams. And Mrs. Hathaway is here with us today. Now the post office. The first post office, Gilead, was established in 1834, and Bishop Chase was the postmaster. Later, the post office was kept by Emerson Marsh at his store at the Corners. James Glass took the first contract to carry the mail to the post office from Brunson, and then he subcontracted it to a Samuel Booth. The fee was $30 a year. The East Gilead Post Office was established in 1857, and Samuel Arnold of Arnold's Corners was the postmaster. The first school in the township was the one kept by Samuel Chase. The first public school, now there's this difference there, you see. The one is a school was kept by Samuel Chase. The first public school was kept by James McKinley, 1836 to 1837. And the first schoolhouse, primitive built on the D.C. May farm near the east shore of Gilead Lake. And that must be about where the Marsh School is and where Mr. Garman went to school. Did you know that was the first site for the school?
Yeah.
A hamlet sprung up at Arnold's Corners named East Gilead. A dozen dwellings, a store, a blacksmith. 1871, Adams Baker run the blacksmith shop. There was a church and a steam sawmill. The mill was a portable one brought there in 1870. A wagon shop was later added to the blacksmith's shop by Franklin Pyatt. John Haynes opened the first store at East Gilead in 1875 for 1 year. The store in 1879 was run by Charles Carroll, the father of C. O'Neill Carroll, and Mr. Carroll lived to be some 90 years of age. He lived about the early 50s, and I can remember his passing there, living in Coldwater, just beyond where the Montgomery Ward or Arnold's Auto Store. He lived upstairs there. C. O'Neill took care of him. C. O'Neill started business there along with his brother Roy and learned the trade. Neil ran the Lockwood store, and then he moved on into Coldwater, and this is where he terminated his business career, and he still lives in Coldwater, and he's about 95, 6, 7 years old. I talked with him about 4 years ago. He was blind in one eye. He was couldn't see well out of the other, and he was feeling his age, but I checked, and no indication at the bank, but what he still is alive. Anyone has had no word, have they, about C. O'Neill Carroll?
I thought he was in Florida.
It is in Florida, Clearwater, Florida.
Yeah.
Yes, right. His brother Roy just passed away, and he ran a store in Brunson. And now, the first town meeting was held April the 3rd, 1837. Probably, nobody knows for sure, in the house of Benjamin Booth. And as I spoke of earlier, Mr. Sanders was elected the first supervisor. Albert Glass was the township clerk. All officers were to serve gratis. This would really balance our budget today, wouldn't it? The high vote for a candidate then was 35. William Purdy was the poundmaster. Jesse Booth and Daniel Marsh were the fence builders. The bounty on wolves were $1, $2, and $3 for the whelps, the males, and the females. So you knew what you could get if you caught up with the wolf. In the record of 1858 of town meeting, it indicated that all bucks were to be restrained from running at large. Violators, after 1 day notice, were $5 a day. Also, 50 cents penalty for each horse running at large. How many of you have traveled through open range country? How many of you have? I see, okay. I remember the Upper Peninsula. We went on our honeymoon up there, and they had it in 1931. So cows were going across the road, and with their bells a tinkling and everything else. The school inspector, after examinations of the prospect to teach, issued 2-year certificates. So this pretty well covers the story of Gilead. I do want to boy's life in Gilead, and this was written by Dudley Chase. And he speaks about the Indians going by their home here, and there's nothing to see from 10 to 30 going single file down the Indian Trail here across Gilead in the 1831 to 36 while Bishop Chase lived here. And the trail was track worn below the sod where for long years past the Indians had traveled in their fashion, single file. And we early made their acquaintance. They were the Pottawatomies, and seldom a day passed that we did not see from 5 to 30 of them. We soon established a scale of barter, and by fair dealing, not manifesting any distrust or fear, though we might have felt both at times, we kept the peace. The gardens were planted with forethought, now furnished with us with vegetables, and the corn, though unfenced, promised a crop. But alas, the loosened animals, now increased by the new arrivals that the bishop had brought, largely cropped the crop for their own benefit. Now here, the farming operation was soon begun in good earnest. We had 3 or 4 hands, but the boys had to pass their apprenticeship, and soon became masters at their trade and learned to do all things better than their teachers and to take the lead and direct. Fences were to be made, the land plowed, planted, sowed, grain reaped, stacked, thrashed, and in time barns and sawmills erected, forest trees cut, lumber sawed, and bricks made. The stock of horses and cattle had to be largely increased and provided for, and to these were added sheep and hogs. The boys managed the stock, trained the horses, handled the plow to break up the sod, sowed grain, made the stack stand in the form of an egg upright. How many of you worked on a stack, by the way? 1 or 2 or 3, huh? If the stack would roll back that and come back, you're all right. You went like this and it stayed while you were in trouble. You know what I mean by stacking. They tramped out the grain with horses, winnowed it by the windmill, washed and sheared the sheep, and took the wool to be woven into cloth, of which the family garments were made at home. They cut down the forest trees in winter and sawed the lumber at their own mill for fencing and building. They had to know what trees to fell for that purpose and to fell and cut and bring the logs by ox team to the mill and there make the lumber of all kinds. And so ends our story here of Gilead for the time being.